Our guest on The Year That Made Me today describes herself as a farmer, scientist and storyteller. Dr. Anika Molesworth is one of the founding directors of Farmers for Climate Action, and she burst onto the farming scene young, being named Australia's Young Farmer of the Year in 2015. Anika also went on to publish the book Our Sunburnt Country, subtitle A Young Farmer Shares How We Can Grow the Courage to Protect Our Land and Save Our Food. These days, she still works on the farm and is still a leading voice for climate-resilient agriculture in this country and around the world. Dr. Anika Molesworth, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much, Julian, for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. Now, Anika, you started off as a city kid. How did you end up on a farm?
So I spent my younger years in Melbourne, you know, the usual suburban upbringing. But then my family purchased a property in far western New South Wales near Broken Hill.
As you don't. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's it. When I was 12 years old. And, you know, what a contrast from those cityscapes to the wide open, endless horizons of Broken Hill. And I was in awe of this place.
Okay, so how did you feel about it when you got the news that you'd be moving to Broken Hill? And clearly it turned out all right.
So each school holidays, we did this 1,000K almost trek up to Broken Hill and spent school holidays on the property out here, which my parents had just purchased. And at the time, it was green and lush, kangaroos, emus, budgerigars, and my jaw just hit the floor. I was just like, my goodness, like what a world. What an incredible landscape for a young person to explore. And I absolutely fell in love with it.
So why did your parents decide to take up farming and how did it go for them?
Well, they both have like environmental interests, and there was always this idea of, you know, reconnecting to the land and playing some role in the farming rural life. And this property came on the market and my parents thought, wow, like what a rugged, wild landscape in far western New South Wales, such a contrast from where we had been based in Melbourne. And the colours out here, the rural community, like there's so much to love. You can really almost see the ends of the earth. Like the horizons just go on forever. The wildlife is incredible. It was bursting with life at that time. And that just made us fall in love with it and think, yeah, let's give this a go.
It sounds absolutely beautiful, but farming is notoriously hard yakka in every sense. And particularly if your parents were taking it on, having not worked on farms before, that's a big thing to do. How did it go?
Well, we recruited a very knowledgeable manager to help us understand the land and livestock management and how to fix fences and repair tractors and like all the basic skills that we did not have. So he was a terrific asset and terrific just wealth of information that we were just craving at the time. But a particular thing happened very shortly after we purchased the farm, and that was the rain stopped falling. And that was the start of the decade-long millennium drought. We purchased in the year 2000, and for much of the country, the rain stopped falling for the next 10 years. So our introduction to agriculture was quite a steep learning curve.
Oh, yeah. Tell us what's on the farm and how it did through those very long drought years.
So we started exploring African breeds of sheep, Dorpas and Damaras, which are quite drought tolerant, quite hardy for more arid, semi-arid environments. And they were doing really well. But then as the drought years progressed and went on and on, we really saw it taking a toll on the land. And so gradually over time, we then had to remove that livestock that we had just purchased and we're just learning how to manage and rear. And over seasons and over years, the land desiccated, you know, the rain stopped, the vegetation disappeared, dust storms started to roll in because there wasn't that ground cover holding it down. The water evaporated from the dams and the creek. The wildlife started to go. So the kangaroos and emus and budgerigars, all those incredible native species that we had fallen in love with, started to vanish from the landscape too. And it was really striking to walk outside and just hear silence. There was just no sound anymore. All those birds that used to sing from the trees had disappeared. And it really struck a chord with me, very much at an emotional, personal level. Like, oh my gosh, like what is going on here? Something bad is going on here. Even as a young person, I could feel that sense from the land, from people in the community, that something very unusual and not very good was occurring.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Dr. Anika Molesworth, and we're talking about the big dry, the millennium drought, and it's from those years that you've chosen the year that made you, Anika. Now, that doesn't really narrow it down, though, because the big dry began in 1996, and I don't think Australia was finally declared drought-free until April of 2012. What year have you chosen and why?
So 2006 was a real pivotal year for me. It was sort of the peak of the drought. It was hot. It was dry. We had destocked our property. I was growing increasingly curious as well as concerned about the state of the environment around me and what was my responsibility in looking after it, caring for it as a land manager.
How old were you in 2006?
I was just going on 19, 20. So I had finished high school. I had taken a gap year and now I was starting university. So I started to study a Bachelor of Science specializing in agribusiness, but I also wanted to learn everything I possibly could about droughts and changes in the climate. Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth also was released that year in 2006. And I remember my dad bringing it home on a Friday evening from the video shop. You know, he'd gone out to get the weekly video rental for us, brought it home from Video Easy. And I was like, oh my gosh, a movie about the weather? Come on, Dad. Like, what a waste of a Friday video rental. Anyway, he put it on and it was really a penny drop moment. I watched that film. I was like, wow, okay, so this is what's happening. This is what I'm actually observing in real life. Like, humans are having a huge impact on the health of our planet, and that's having a dramatic impact on the climate and extreme weather events, such as the drought. And at the time, this drought was unprecedented. Like, it was going on for so long. It was so dry. It was so widespread over Australia. And I could walk out the front door and feel that heat, feel that emptiness of life. And I was like, gosh, like I'm witnessing this in real life. So as I then started my university degree in agribusiness, I was trying to select as many electives and classes as possible related to climate and environment and how do we take care and nurture the health of our world so that we as land managers can actually produce food and nurture community.
So were there options within your Bachelor of Science degree in agribusiness to focus on things like climate change back in 2006?
There were a lot of different pathways that you could focus on with agribusiness because, as we know, like agriculture is so diverse, so incredible. Climate wasn't really a standout theme or topic. There weren't many subjects. So when assignments were being put forward to me and gave you a little bit of wiggle room of what you wanted to focus on, I deliberately was focusing on climate. I was going out and designing my assignments and research topics around climate because that is what I wanted to learn more about. And in one way, it was learning about this from a very selfish perspective in that I want to take on the family farm one day. I want a future out here on my home. Like, I love this place and I want to know how to do that. And it wasn't until later that I thought, my gosh, there are so many other young people, farmers, young agriculturalists who also want that. And so how do I then help share information that I'm learning and advocate for a healthier planet and healthier farm systems?
What sort of a response did you get from your lecturers and teachers when you raised this interest in climate change?
Look, a few of them were quite supportive and sort of gave me some good direction. A few of them were, oh, you know, that's an interesting topic, but, you know, a bit dismissive of it. I think fast forward to now, there are very much structured programs around climate change and people in university can very much easily learn about these topics. But yeah, going back to when I was just starting out, it wasn't so much the done thing.
And we've talked about you being at university. Many people might think of being in an inner city environment, hanging out at bars and things like that. But your experience of university was quite different, Anika, because you studied agriculture remotely. Tell us about that.
That's right. So I've done all of my studies, and I ended up doing 13 years at university remotely. So I've been living out here in far western New South Wales or central New South Wales, and I've been able to live amongst rural communities, live on landscapes, study agriculture firsthand, and then do my assignments, do my research from the desktop all remotely. And I think that's been fabulous that I can actually go outside, be amongst it all, and then apply this practical knowledge, to this work that I was actually learning through the university system.
So 13 years of tertiary education, that's a big stint, but not all of it in Broken Hill. Studying for your master's took you to Laos. Why was that?
Yes, I was about to say, you know, those 13 years wasn't doing my bachelor because I was a very terrible student. So I did my Bachelor of Science in Agribusiness, then a Master's of Sustainable Agriculture, and then went on to do a PhD in Agriculture and Environmental Management. So the Master's, yes, was partially based in Laos in Southeast Asia, and it was this fantastic experience to work with farmers and agricultural scientists in a very different country, in a very different context, but to hear their experiences of climate change and environmental change and how it was impacting their food and fiber production systems.
And speaking to farmers in Laos, what did you find were the points of commonality and what did you learn from the points of difference?
So a lot of these farmers that I was working with, older generation farmers who had no formal education on climate change, and yet could tell me in such detail how the climate was changing. They could describe the new insects that they were seeing eating their crops. They could tell me the number of days that the dry season was extending each year and how the temperature is increasing each year. And when I would ask them via translator, why do you think this is occurring? They would point to the mountains and they would say, because the trees are being removed, we are having these extreme weather events and these changes in the climate. And interestingly, they put a lot of that removal of trees down to creating anger in the spirits, because they believe that, you know, their ancestors live in the forest, live in the mountains, and by destroying the mountain forests, you were angering the spirits. And so this was sort of a punishment for people because of the deforestation occurring. So that was interesting that they were coming to that conclusion, which in a sense is very right, because we are removing forests and deforesting and not looking after the land properly, that we are causing these extreme weather events to occur.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Dr. Anika Molesworth, and the doctor indicates, Anika, that you did a PhD that was largely focused in Cambodia. Tell us about that experience.
That's right. So the PhD was partially in Griffith in central New South Wales and partially in Cambodia.
Which is quite the contrast.
Yeah, that's right. Two very different farming systems. So in central New South Wales, in around Griffith, high productivity, high tech, high access to information and science, versus going to rural Cambodia. And again, a fantastic learning experience to see how small-scale subsistence farmers with lower access to tech and new information, etc., are managing a changing climate. And I think so often we take our food systems and our agricultural systems for granted here in Australia. You know, we are so lucky, we are so privileged to be able to walk into a supermarket and see stocked shelves. In Cambodia and in Laos, these rural communities don't have that luxury. And when they are hit by an extreme weather event, be it a drought, a flood, a pest outbreak, or family illness, anything like that, food does not get produced. Communities start going hungry. And so the impacts of climate change are just felt so much more immediately and severely. And I think that's something that we need to remember, that we are all part of this global food and farming system, and our actions, no matter where we are in the world, do impact others. And by that, I'm sort of referring to emissions that we create in Australia, or how we manage our environment here in Australia does go on to flow on to impact people in other countries who have a lot less adaptive capacity to deal with extreme weather events.
So obviously climate change was something that was a direct personal concern because of your work on the family farm, and it's something that you're studying extensively in Australia and in the region. When and how did you get involved in public advocacy, Anika?
So I was learning all this fantastic information from my university studies and working with researchers and farmers both here in Australia and around the world. And I was becoming increasingly frustrated by the narrative I was hearing in the media about, you know, the climate debate and the science is still out. And I was hearing that from leaders in our country also. And that was, you know, frustration as well as a great concern of mine. I was witnessing this firsthand, the impact of the drought. I was witnessing what it meant for people in developing countries actually going hungry because of these extreme weather events. And then I was hearing this misinformation, disinformation about climate change not being as serious as it actually is. And so I really stumbled and tripped into the world of advocacy and public speaking on this topic, because naturally I'm very introverted. I love being out here in far western New South Wales and talking with my dog and a few sheep. Standing up on a stage or holding a microphone was very foreign for me. But I very soon realized that if I'm not speaking out about this issue, if I'm not sharing these stories, then who is? And are they going to be sharing the right information and the right stories in the right way? So I started talking about climate change, how it impacts agriculture. I then learned for people to feel engaged and to listen, you have to bring in your own personal story. And so that's when I started to describe my own personal experiences and what I was learning and what I was seeing. But not only the concern about what climate change is doing to our food and farming systems, but also my hopes and my visions, because I do believe like we can have flourishing, bountiful, plentiful food and farming systems. I do believe that we can have a healthy, vibrant planet, but we really do need to take steps to actually get there. And so a lot of my talking and messaging is around, let's get our act together. Let's actually create that planet, that vision that we hold in our minds for the betterment of everyone.
In 2015, you were one of the founding directors of the organization Farmers for Climate Action. How did that come about?
So a group of about 30 farmers got together in the Blue Mountains, and we sat down around a campfire and we talked about how climate change was impacting our farms. And these were farmers from dairy farmers from the Gippsland to banana growers in tropical North Queensland to me in the arid regions of New South Wales. We all came from different places and different industries, but our stories were very similar in how a changing climate, how changing rainfall patterns, higher temperatures, extreme weather events were impacting our capacity to produce food and feed our communities, how it was having real significant business impact, you know, reduced profitability and productivity on our farms. And so we thought, well, how about we establish a group, an organization, and see who comes and joins us? And at the time, we had very modest hopes, you know, we'll set up a Facebook group and see who joins. Fast forward a decade, this group has become a national movement of farmers around the country, of every different industry, leading climate solutions in agriculture, championing climate solutions, saying that we can reduce a emissions from our farms, we can reduce emissions from rural communities. And by doing so, we are going to benefit the productivity and profitability and health of our farming and rural communities. And so it's been this most incredible, inspiring journey of people coming together and working on some of the biggest, complex, most daunting challenges of our time, but with such hope and determination and vision. And every day it is inspiring to work with Farmers for Climate Action.
So it started with a collection of about 30 farmers. You said it's grown over a decade. What sort of scale has Farmers for Climate Action got to, Anika? And I suppose, what's your sense of the broad state of opinion about climate change in the farming sector in Australia today?
I think it's just gone to show in that past decade, like the thousands and thousands of people who have come to our community events, joined our online learning webinars, written articles for papers, spoken on radio, put signs on their farm gate saying, "I am a farmer for climate action," has just gone to show that there is just an overwhelming support in their agricultural community for action on climate change. Because farmers feel the impacts of climate change first and foremost. We work with the natural world. We depend on stable rainfall and temperature and seasonal conditions. And as the climate disrupts, producing food and feeding people becomes more and more challenging. But we also know by taking action on climate change, there are just so many benefits that flow back to rural communities. And looking at what we have achieved in the last few years and the last decade has been phenomenal, but we also know that there is so much more work that needs to be done. And that's why an organization like Farmers for Climate Action is so critical to keep putting that pressure on the wider community to say, we still need to be working on this. We still need to be reducing emissions, and we can do that. We know what to do. This is about will and determination now. The need for action on climate change and the urgency for that action on climate change has never been greater. And farmers who are managing the land and water and biodiversity and growing food have never felt so much pressure by climate change, so much challenge in producing food and earning an income, earning livelihoods from their farming businesses. Is it being heard by our policymakers? No, not all of them, not at all. And that's why it's so important that we as individuals, no matter where we are and what we do, farmer or not farmer, stand up and say, I want to make sure that I have food on my plate, healthy, nutritious food. I want to be able to afford that food. I want to go into a shop and see food on the shelves. And if we lose the battle on climate change, we're going to lose those things. Food will become less accessible, less available. Food will become increasingly more expensive. We can all think back to those cyclones in Queensland that smashed banana crops and bananas went up to like $15 a kilogram. Prices rise an incredible amount when we experience extreme weather events. We also know that climate change impacts the nutritional quality of food. And we all want our children eating nutrient-dense foods, not foods that have been robbed of nutrients because we have lost soil fertility. So there are so many reasons why everyone, because we all eat foods, needs to be speaking out for climate action and speaking out on behalf of the farming and rural communities to say, you know, we want vibrant farming communities, we want healthy rural communities, and we're only going to have that if we have the serious ambition action on climate change.
Anika, you and the family got into farming in a very tough time. How's the farm going today?
It's looking really beautiful out the window at the moment. The sun is shining. There are zebra finches nesting under my veranda. I saw some emus bathing in a small pond that we have in the paddock yesterday, which was just lovely. So it's gorgeous. But I also look at the future forecasts with a growing sense of anxiety. We are being told that we're going into an El Nino and possibly a super El Nino, which means it's going to be hotter and drier. Out here in Broken Hill, last summer we had 2 weeks over 40 degrees. It is unbearable to go out in the middle of the day. It has incredible, dire impact on the wildlife and livestock and vegetation. And so as we approach summer again, I'm sure that there are many land managers around the country who are dreading that heat and that dryness. And again, it's a reinforcement, a reminder why we need to be taking care of the climate and this precious planet we call home.
You mentioned that during the big dry, your family farm had to destock. Have you restocked since?
We are currently resting the land. So we did destock, we restocked. Like many farmers, we very much respond to seasonal conditions. So when seasons are good, you can build up numbers, purchase in livestock. When seasons turn, then you sell your livestock and sometimes you destock completely. So we had destocked around a few years ago because we just wanted to rebuild the seed in our soil, make sure that the vegetation was in as strong and healthy condition as possible. And again, as we look towards the future and a heating and drying climate, one really has to ask questions of what does a responsible land manager need to do to take care of this special place?
Well, it's been fantastic speaking with you, and particularly lovely hearing your description of the beautiful farm that you're sitting on and looking out over as we speak. Anika Molesworth, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much, Julian.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. You're in the country. Are we going for country music, Anika?
Yes, I have selected John Wibberley, his song called Sally, which is a beautiful song that I put on when I'm cruising down the highway, looking out at the endless horizon. It's a great road trip song. So I hope you enjoy it.
Fantastic. Here it is, John Wibberley. This is Sally.
We bought a whole lot of car for not much money. It was older than both of us, and our dreams kept it running.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.